Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight began making rounds in hospitals at age 8, carrying his dad's surgeon's bag. He earned a medical degree from the University of Michigan and became an intern at Children's Hospital of Michigan in 1976. He then became a pediatrician and a child and family advocate. In 2005, he was named the president of Children's Hospital of Michigan, leading 1,900 team members. His name, Dr. Herman Gray, and we're honored to have him as our guest. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the president of Children's Hospital of Michigan, Dr. Herman Gray. Doctor, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Absolutely. I grew up in the city of Detroit, never strayed very far. My dad was from Jamaica, the island of Jamaica. He was a pharmacist practicing there and decided that he wanted to be a doctor and came to the United States to go to medical school and went to medical school in Boston. And when he finished, he came to Detroit to practice and found a receptionist in another doctor's office who looked like more than just a receptionist to him, my mother. And so they married, and I was born here in Detroit and grew up for the first 12 or 13 years of my life with both of my parents, somewhere around 13 years of age, my dad decided to return to Jamaica. Around that time, Jamaica, as you may know, got its independence from Great Britain, and he wanted to be back in the land of his birth, and for, I think, lots of reasons, thought it would be a better place for him to practice. And my mother, who was from Valdosta, Georgia, didn't know too much about Jamaica, said, well, Herman Jr. and Denise are going to stay here with me, and you can go back to Jamaica if you want to, but that's not for us. And so my parents got divorced, and the rest is, I guess, family history.
What did you learn, Doctor, from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad, the surgeon?
Yeah, my mother was certainly most influential in our lives and in terms of raising us. Certainly my dad, even when he was with us in Detroit, was traveling a great deal. At that time, it was virtually impossible for African-American physicians to get privileges, medical staff privileges, in the majority hospitals. And my dad traveled. I have very clear memories of him traveling to Roanoke, Virginia, which was, I think, the last place he practiced before he went to back home to Jamaica. He practiced in North Carolina. He practiced around the country, and he would literally go there during the week and drive home on the weekends. So my mother, was the primary caregiver for my sister and I. And my mother was a high school graduate, but was very devoted to the notion that to better yourself in life, you had to be well-educated. She devoted herself to her children, and she had a very strong ethic of giving to others. She was 4 feet 11 tall, I think in our eyes was probably 8 feet tall. She was extraordinarily generous, a kind, caring, giving person, very spiritual. Made us go to church every Sunday, whether we wanted to or not, into Sunday school and to sing in choir and to do all those kind of things. My dad, on the other hand, was an intellectual giant, also of a strong sense of giving to others. I made rounds with him not only when I was a youngster here in Detroit, but when I visited him in Jamaica. I made house calls there, and he would give away medical care in exchange for a chicken or a bottle of rum or some eggs or will you paint my house next year? Sure, okay, fine. Well, that'd cover it. So from both parents, certainly a sense of giving back, being grateful for what you have, and the way to pay back is to do something for others. And my dad was the doc. And from as early in my life as I can remember, I wanted to be a physician. My mother tells me that when I was 2 or 3 years old, I would pick up his doctor bag and carry it around the house and pretend like I was a doc. That is, I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else.
You earn a degree, medical degree, from the U of M, and then you become an intern at Children's Hospital 31 years ago. Right. How did you get that job?
Well, the as a University of Michigan graduate, I had lots of opportunities to go where I wanted to. The decision to be a pediatrician was probably the challenging decision, not really having planned that. I thought I was going to be a surgeon like my father or an internist, but I fell in love with pediatrics during my student years at University of Michigan. And so then I thought about, well, where do you want to practice and how do you want to practice? And it was my intent all along to come back to Detroit to take care of lots of kids for decades and then have them all throw a great big retirement party for me, and I would sit in a rocking chair and retire gracefully in Detroit. And I thought that the Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit would be a better place to prepare me for that in terms of training than perhaps the University of Michigan would, which is more of a referral-type hospital. And so I came here to do my training.
Like your dad, you become a physician, and like your dad, you meet a lady at the workplace.
Yeah, who'd have thought?
Who'd have thought? Talk about Shirley.
Shirley was a young social worker who started in May of 1976 at Children's Hospital of Michigan. Having moved here from Brownsville, Tennessee, a couple years before, and to get her graduate degree at Wayne State. And I started in July in 1976 with Shirley, and we ended up doing a couple of rotations together. She was a social worker on one of our inpatient units in the hospital, and I was rotating through that unit, and I struck up a conversation. She studiously ignored me, and I persistently chased her until she would talk to me.
We're talking to Dr. Herman Gray. When we come back, we'll talk to him about a miracle in Detroit, Children's Hospital of Michigan. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Dr. Herman Gray, who has been with the Children's Hospital of Michigan for 31 years. Doctor, every time I walk through Children's, the culture of love permeates the place.
Right.
Why and how?
You know, doctors love why questions. I wish I could tell you. The place has unchanged. Certainly in my lifetime, my adult experience with it in the 30 years or so that I've been associated off and on with Children's Hospital of Michigan, our culture is 120 years ago that Dr. Charles Dievendorf and a group of volunteer women established the hospital when he found a child that was dying dying from diphtheria and was living in circumstances that were just really deplorable. And so the hospital was established, I think, by well-meaning, philanthropic, community-oriented women who loved children and wanted to do better for children, and I think that started our tradition. Certainly, we talk a lot about this at our place. Every employee hears that directly from me. I speak to every new employee every month at our orientation, and we talk about what is it that makes Children's Hospital of Michigan a special place. And certainly the fact that we have scanners and devices and surgeons and physicians who do all kinds of golly gee whiz bang kind of technological things is critically important to what we do, and don't underestimate that for a moment. But the thing that is most important in our institution is how people are received. Do they feel supported? Do they feel that their child's needs and their family needs come first and foremost by our employees? And so whether it's how you're greeted by the valet, how you're welcomed by the person in the parking booth, whether the woman who helps to clean the room says hello and smiles and asks how your child is doing, or whether it's the nurse or neurosurgeon, doesn't make any difference. That every one of those employees has a sense of responsibility towards making the stay of a child and the stay of a family as positive as they can. And we try to hire people who are there because they love children, of course. it would be pretty tough to have people working in a children's hospital that didn't like kids. And in the few occasions that we find those, we try to find another place for them to work, quite frankly, because the environment has to be supportive. We focus on families and children because the care is so much more than just the technical aspects of providing the care. Lots of people can be competent and proficient at that, but the environment and how people feel when they walk in those doors is absolutely critical to our success and their well-being.
Recently, you spent a day with the Duchess of York, walking her around the hospital.
Right.
When I first met you, you were a pediatrician. You know, you were a humble doctor. Now you're with duchesses and kings. Can you share that experience with Sarah Ferguson?
Oh, it was fantastic. Back in the fall, Duchess chose Children's Hospital of Michigan as one of the places to visit as part of Child World Health Day. And she had been to visit several other children's hospitals around the country and indeed around the world before she came to Detroit and subsequently went to visit a couple of other children's hospitals in China and elsewhere. And she's a very humble, down-to-earth person. Clearly my first experience meeting royalty, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I certainly didn't expect to see the Duchess of York sitting on a floor in the auditorium playing games with kids or making plaster casts of her hands so that we could put imprints of her hands up on our wall that we're building in our garden outside the hospital. And she commented to us after walking around for a while that she was really impressed with the place. She really liked it. And then she said something that really sort of hit me in the gut. She said, "This is one of the best children's hospitals, if not the best children's hospital I have ever visited. There's something about the environment here. The people are warm and caring and inviting and friendly. It's a blue-collar town. There's no pretentiousness. People just want to do the right thing for kids. And this is one of the best places I've ever been as far as children's hospitals go, and I've been to a lot of them, and I want to do something to help you." And we actually are waiting to work with her on what those plans might be to help the Children's Hospital of Michigan. But she was impressed, even as a visitor for a brief period of time, of what the place was like. She spent a good day there, and her handlers, as it were, ultimately had to convince her to leave because she was off schedule and she just wanted to kind of hang around with us. It was an absolutely wonderful experience.
You've been around thousands, tens of thousands of sick children and SIDS infants for 3+ decades. Mm-hmm. What have these sick children taught you?
Well, certainly, first and foremost, I think, is that I am truly blessed. I'm blessed in a number of ways. One is the privilege to share some of the most intimate moments of people's lives with them. When people's children's lives are being threatened in some way by illness, injury, or indeed when they lose a baby from sudden infant death syndrome or SIDS, you share with them that pain, that anguish, that anxiety, that apprehension about what's going to happen to their youngster. And it's really a privilege to be there and to share that. No other profession, I think, gets as close to other human beings. Perhaps ministers in their own way, certainly. But physicians have the privilege to be very, very close, not just physically, but emotionally, psychologically, spiritually to other people. And sharing that is a real privilege. Certainly, you learn that life is precious and that you don't take it for granted. You learn that I have a skill that was developed, that I worked hard for, and there's a meaning and a reason for why I've developed the skill. And to be able to apply the skills that I acquired to other people and to see them get better, to see the many professionals in our place apply these extraordinary skills to children and see them get better is amazing. But even when things don't go well, because certainly every child is not a cure, every person that walks through our door doesn't go back out. Certainly, even under those circumstances, to know that you can still have a very positive influence on people's lives. Some of the most compelling stories I have had people tell me about in their experience at Children's Hospital have resulted in the death of their child. And so it's not like the outcome was all that great from a medical point of view, but what they felt and how they were received and how they were taken care of and during the time that's arguably the absolute worst time in their lives, really speaks to what the nobility of the practice of medicine is and healthcare.
You have a world-class neonatal ICU unit where regularly you have a couple of 1-pound babies.
Sure.
1 pound. Can you talk about one-pound babies?
These are, you know, babies that, you know, when I was a young intern, certainly we would have argued vigorously with our teachers that we shouldn't even be trying to save them because they were just too small, and all we were doing was prolonging the agony of trying to care for them and keep them alive. And you know, pediatric science and medicine has been able to push the envelope so much that babies who routinely, you know, we would have died, who would have died 30 years ago are routinely surviving. Certainly, you know, 90% of babies at that size, you know, ought to survive and do, you know, well. Not just survive, but to do well. And so, certainly, I have the advantage of being bald-headed and gray-haired and seeing over time the evolution of the practice of medicine and what we can do. And we're really pushing the envelope here.
We're talking to Dr. Herman Gray, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Herman Gray, who is a pediatrician and a child and family advocate. Doctor, your eyes over these last 30 plus years have seen thousands of miracles and hundreds of deaths. Mm-hmm. It's Easter tonight. Why does God allow these deaths to these children?
Well, certainly I don't hold myself out to be a theologian. I'm a simple pediatrician, you know, running a hospital and trying to do the best that I can, and to live my faith every day. And certainly during this Holy Week and the holiest of times for Christians, that's a great question to ask, clearly a pretty hard question to answer. My approach to this is that all things work for the good, that there are reasons for why things happen that, you know, I certainly cannot understand. I see things happen and have seen things happen with children in my practice and in the practice of others that I cannot explain, that have happened that have been extraordinarily positive and that were unexpected, as well as things that have happened that have been really pretty negative. That I could not explain or predict it. And I think that you know, our job is to learn from what happens around us, recognize that God doesn't want us to be in pain, and that there are lessons to be learned in life, that sometimes we don't even learn until years later, that we may not understand why it happened. But I have seen families that you know, I certainly wouldn't say that death was a good thing for them of their child, but who have grown tremendously from the experience that they had, who have gone on to volunteer in the hospital and who have touched lives of countless number of children, or who have been motivated to go back to school to do something. You know, I had one little guy named Mikey who whose mother, as a result of his death, went back and became a radiology technician because she saw Mikey, who was named after the little guy with the red hair on the Life cereal commercials. She saw Mikey have so many x-rays and ultrasounds of his head during the time that he was in our neonatal ICU in the 70s. And so, you know, I don't think we can understand why these things happen, but recognize, I think, that that we are all children of God, and some of us have longer and shorter times to spend here than others, but that all life is valuable, and that we treat each other with respect, dignity, and love, and we learn from each other.
When we come back, we'll ask Dr. Gray about how these children change families. I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
We're talking to Dr. Herman Gray. Doctor, I marvel when I meet families who have a special needs child or a sick child. Ultimately, they refer to that child as hero, teacher, angel from God, our inspiration. How do you explain this?
You're absolutely right. This is very common to see and to hear. And you know, I think vicariously, you know, I've not had a child with special needs in my own family, but I think even vicariously I've experienced that. If I start to feel sorry for myself, the day's not going all so well, people are abusing me for whatever reason from my very selfish perspective, I just need to get in an elevator, walk up on the fourth, fifth, or sixth floors of the hospital, and it gives me a little bit of a reality check, because you see small children, young children, youth struggling against circumstances that are really extraordinarily challenging, and the way they embrace life and want to live and want to play and want to have fun under circumstances that, you know, for many adults would be defeating, is an inspiration to watch. And I think that families who have children with special needs see that on a day-to-day basis. They know how hard it is. They understand the difficulties of just moving from one spot to another, maybe, for this youngster. They see the pain. They experience all the pokes and the uncomfortable procedures that are done, but yet the child continues to be childlike, to be pure and loving and not bitter. And I think it teaches you, how to have grace under pressure. And so these children, I think, also teach us unselfishness, that they give love and with no strings attached. They love you because you're there. You're the parent. You're the doctor. You're the nurse. You're just a nice person that came in the room. It's unconditional love from children who are really struggling. And so I think that, when it gets down to it and people look at what the meaning of life is and how to make their life more meaningful to them as individuals, there's lots of lessons that these children teach us. And so I think that's a big part of why families describe their kids that way.
Every time I walk through the hospital, certain things scream out at me. One, love, mm-hmm. which we've all talked about already. Then three other things: patience, hope, and surrender to God.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about patience?
Oh boy, there's lots of patience in the children's hospital, that's for sure. You have kids who may or may not want to do what you've asked them to do. We walked through the rehab gym when you came to visit with us, and you had kids who were being pushed to do more than they particularly either thought they could do or wanted to do, or they were just getting tired, and the therapist there just keeps gently urging them on. You see patients and manifest in many ways. The other way that's not quite as acute, that is, that stretches out over time, patience over time, is that changes and improvements may be very small from one day to the next. And to have the patience to expect to see improvement and change over a long period of time is also remarkable. And so a physician who prescribes a certain intervention for a child or performs a certain procedure may not see the fruits of that labor for weeks or years, indeed. I've seen children where you've said to the parent, "I really don't know what's going to happen, but we will know, maybe in 5 or 6 years." That's pretty challenging. For adults, certainly pretty soon whether or not things are going to go in the right direction or not. For children, because their brains are so flexible, that they're so resilient, that even when things look really very bad, they can turn out really very good over time. And so having the patience to wait that long to see it can sometimes be challenging.
Hope and surrender to God.
Hope is absolutely critical in what we do. And it certainly is critical in all of medicine. But in the field that I practice in, it's absolutely critical to be a successful practitioner. You cannot deny a family or a patient or a child of hope, even when the circumstances look bleak, that there is no hope from a medical point of view. I have seen things happen that I just cannot explain. So as an example, I saw a young child when I was a young pediatrician in practice who had a severe case of meningitis. We saw a lot more meningitis in those days than we do now. This was a bacterial meningitis. Brain damage is very common in certain types of it. And indeed, we were able to document with a CT scan, a CAT scan, of how significant this child's brain damage was as a infant. And I remember showing the x-ray to the mother, a very simple, salt-of-the-earth, good person, not highly educated, and showing her the areas of the brain where fluid had replaced brain tissue. The infection had been that severe. And tried to explain to her, as best we understood it, what the implications of that were for the child in the long term. Possible blindness, possible inability to feed herself, possible not being able to walk, just not a good prognosis. And the mother looked at it and said, "I understand what you're telling me, but I think it's going to be okay." And I had the privilege to follow that youngster over years' time. And the last time I saw her, she was 7 years old in second grade. And this is certainly not anything I would have expected. But that mother was hopeful for a good outcome. She wasn't unrealistic. I mean, she heard what we said and understood it and accepted it. But she was hopeful. And it underscored that we don't know everything that's going to happen, which I think leads to the last thing you asked about in terms of surrender to God. Sometimes you reach the point, and particularly in an institution like ours, that is the last resort for many children. You know, if you can't be taken care of properly as a very, very sick child in the Children's Hospital of Michigan, there aren't many other places in the world where you can go. This is a world-class children's hospital where this is where the experts are. And sometimes, even in a place like ours, you have done absolutely everything that you can do. And there really isn't anything else to do except give it over to God and wait and see what's going to happen to keep that child comfortable, to keep the family informed and hopeful, but to not misrepresent what's going to happen. But you certainly develop a very strong sense of humility working in a place like ours, that you aren't as smart as you think you are, you don't know everything, that you can't anticipate the future. Certainly we're well-trained, and the docs in our place and the nurses and other caregivers are experts in what they do. But even as experts, that has very significant limitations.
You lead a team of 1,900 people.
Yeah.
350 full-time doctors, 650 nurses. Talk about your team.
Oh, it's an absolute great place, and a great team of people. I am so privileged to be the leader of this group of folks, this team, and it really is a team. We work together to coordinate children's care. These are people who are there because they want to do the right thing for children. They are absolutely committed to our mission. Whether it is the housekeepers, the valet parkers, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the child life specialists, the social workers, the physicians, I mean, they are all there for the same reason, and they bring their own particular expert skills to make sure that kids and families get the best that they can possibly get from us.
We're talking to Dr. Herman Gray, and he and the board are exploring a campaign to build a new hospital. When we come back, we'll talk to him about that. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Herman Gray. Doctor, you and the board are currently exploring a possible campaign to raise $150 million for a new hospital. Why do we need a new hospital?
You sound like a board member. The Children's Hospital of Michigan, the current building that they occupy, opened in 1971. So the facility is now 35-plus years old. It was designed to handle somewhere in the neighborhood of 8,000 inpatient admissions, and we have roughly 14,000 admissions every year to the hospital. It was designed to see roughly 35,000 children in the emergency department, and in 2006 we saw 92,000. It was designed to do six or 7,000 surgeries annually, most of them as inpatients, and we now do close to 15,000 surgeries, most of them as outpatients. So the facility has not kept up with our tremendous growth and needs. This is something that's happening across the country. Children's hospitals everywhere are experiencing this kind of growth, and we'll probably continue to see it for some time to come. As the geriatric population grows, the baby boomers get older, they are taking up more and more time and space in the hospitals that routinely were taking care of kids. And so in this community, as an example, the Henry Ford Hospital several years ago got out of the inpatient pediatric business because they could better utilize that space for adults, and they knew they had a world-class children's hospital right down the street. And so it's been a great partnership for us to see their patients that are admitted by their pediatricians. Similarly, we anticipate that the adult hospitals around our community will increasingly have more challenges providing care to kids. In addition to this, we're seeing the number of physician specialists in pediatrics, both surgeons and medical specialists, become more and more difficult to find. And where they practice is very important. And so getting a world-class physician to come to Detroit to practice at the Children's Hospital of Michigan, we need to provide them with great facilities. Probably most importantly is that every child that gets admitted to our hospital deserves a room that they can have their parent stay in with them comfortably. Certainly when I was an intern at 8 o'clock, you know, the music would come on and visiting hours were announced to be over, and you know, parents and everybody else just kind of walked out of the building and left the child with the nurses, who then said, "Oh, great, you know, now we can take care of the kids without, you know, all those family people in the way." You know, the times have changed tremendously. Certainly every expectation now is that every family wants to stay with their child. And so in rooms that were designed for two kids and no place or very limited place for a parent to sleep, you know, we now need, you know, single rooms and a place for parents to sleep. And so the needs of the consumer, the needs of the patient, the needs of the family have changed fairly dramatically. I would emphasize that we can't build a new hospital for $150 million. We can build a patient tower that expands our capacity. The existing facility will remain as it is, and some parts of it will get renovated. There will be a patient tower to go along with this. This is presuming, of course, that our board approves this project, that the DMC leadership approves this project. And so right now we're simply talking and planning, but we're very hopeful that we'll be able to make a formal announcement about this sometime in the future.
Edsel and Cynthia Ford, Stuart and Maxine Frankel, Johnny and Marion Giannopoulos, Rich and Leslie Helpe, Bruce and Rosalie Rosen. These couples, families, and others, what have they meant to Children's Hospital of Michigan?
These are giants to our community and certainly to the Children's Hospital of Michigan in particular. They have allowed us to do things that we would otherwise have a great deal of difficulty providing for our children. So as an example, the ability to perform robotic surgery. Children's Hospital of Michigan was the first children's hospital in the world, not in Detroit, not in Michigan, not in America, in the world, to perform robotic surgery on a child. And that was through the generous support of donors. We have an advocacy institute where we advocate formally on behalf of children, whether it's car seats, whether it's advocating against child abuse. We are one of the few children's hospitals in the country that has an endowed professorship in child abuse. We were able to recruit a world-class pediatrician who is an expert in child maltreatment, abuse, and neglect as a result of a generous donor. The Sparky Anderson Catch Fund, which Edsel Ford for many years stewarded has been, you know, primarily a support to the Children's Hospital. And so if a family comes in and they need a ride home, that cab voucher, that cab ticket is paid for out of the Catch Fund. If they haven't been able to pay their electric bill and the electricity got turned off, and so we can't send them home, you know, a child that's discharged from the hospital, you know, they can't even keep their medicine in the refrigerator because there's no electricity. That is paid for out of the Catch Fund. It pays for our pediatric mobile team, where we take our experts and our care and go to places around the community to find kids who might not be able to get to our place. All kinds of things happen in our hospital because of the generosity of wealthy donors. But in addition to these extraordinary individuals and families, we have lots of support from, you know, the average middle-class family that sends in their $5, $10, $25 donations. our hospital could not function at the high level that it does without the generous support of donors.
For decades, you were a doctor, a pediatrician, and world class. And then in August 2005, you become the president. Now you're a leader of 1,900 people. How have you made the adjustment?
There are days when I still long to be a simple pediatrician. certainly the practice of medicine isn't simple, and to my colleagues out there who are probably screaming right now, I'm not suggesting that their jobs are simple by any stretch of the imagination, but the issues are pretty straightforward in a pediatric practice, whereas the complexities of leading some 2,000 or so folks, including lots of physicians, can sometimes be challenging. It takes time. And I was real clear that this was what I wanted to do before I took it. Nobody twisted my arm into throwing my hat in the ring to be considered for the presidency. There's lots of really wonderful people who work there, and particularly in my senior leadership team, that make it a lot easier as well. I don't have the answers to everything. Certainly, I'm not expected to have the answers. I'm certainly expected to make sure that we get answers. And so putting together a great team of individuals that are not only people of integrity, honesty, and talent, but who are committed to our mission, has really allowed that transition to help me make that transition much easier.
We hear that there are thousands of openings for nurses in this state.
Yes.
Why should somebody consider becoming a nurse?
Nursing is an absolutely noble profession. Certainly, I cannot tell anyone that if they go to nursing school that they're going to be absolutely wealthy as a result of that decision. But I can tell them that they will have a profession in which their individual efforts are recognized and supported, where they work in a team of smart and dedicated people, where every day when they go to work, the day is not like the day before, that they will be challenged intellectually, and that people will love them and be eternally grateful to them. I get letters virtually every week talking about the wonderful nurses who work in our hospital and the care that they gave. More than anyone else, they are giving the hands-on direct care to children, and they benefit from it, I think.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
As a pediatrician, it's my job to sort of help kids, and that's for me, I think, a fairly simple question to answer. One is that you need to have a dream, a vision of where it is that you want to go. Write it down if you can, as much specificity as you know. You may not know really exactly what you want specifically, but have a dream, and then talk to people about what that dream is. And when you find people that don't think you can do it or don't want you to do it, don't talk to them anymore. Find somebody that will give you positive reinforcement, one. Two, be persistent. Persevere. Lots of times you're going to get knocked down. People are going to tell you can't do it. I can't tell you how many times it happened to me. Persevere. Just stick with it. And lastly, God gives us many rules to live by, and they're pretty simple. Love your neighbor like yourself. Treat others with respect and love and dignity. Do that, and I think you'll be okay.
Well, you've done better than okay. You're a modern-day hero in this town. Thanks a million for sharing your amazing and inspiring story.
Thanks for the chance.
Our guest next Sunday will be the president and executive director of the DSO, Ann Parsons. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spalding.